From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The Syrian army announced a large-scale offensive aimed at retaking several key cities and regions from various terrorist groups after Russian forces paved the way with a week-long bombing campaign. General Ali Abdullah Ayyub, head of the Syrian General Staff, announcing the offensive Thursday, said it was made possible by Russia's military support of the Syrian government. Syrian troops launched a ground offensive amid Russian airstrikes in the provinces of Hama and Idlib in western Syria, targeting members of the so-called Islamic State Wednesday, in the first major ground fighting since Russia began launching airstrikes on ISIS militias September 30th. According to a poll conducted in September by Orb International, more than 80% of Syrians and 80% of Iraqis believe that ISIS was created by the U.S. The entry of Russia into the war in Syria was the subject of discussion at a meeting of NATO as defense ministers of all 28 member states met in Brussels Thursday. Earlier in the day, a spokesperson for the military alliance's secretary general gave the press a little insight into the group's view of Russia's recent activities in Syria.
I mean, you have a number of keywords if you cooperate in the fight against ISIL. You're constructive, you're reliable, and you're cooperative. Russia is not constructive, not reliable, and not cooperative, so it's of great concern.
NATO's chief, Jens Stoltenberg, was much more specific about his feelings at the opening of Thursday's session.
In Syria, we have seen a troubling escalation of Russian military activities. We will assess the latest developments and their implications for the security of the alliance. This is particularly relevant in the view of the recent violations of NATO's airspace by Russian aircraft. NATO is able and ready to defend all allies, including Turkey, against any threats. And one of the main reasons why we have increased the readiness, the preparedness of our forces, why we have doubled the size of the NATO response force, why we have established a very high readiness joint task force, why we have increased the efficiency of decision-making, all of this is a response both to the challenges we see to the east, but also to the challenges we see to the south, with the turmoil, with the violence which we have seen in Syria and in Iraq.
The recently re-elected head of Greece's leftist government, Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, received more than enough support to win a confidence vote Thursday, just ahead of Athens' first bailout review. Tsipras said in a speech before the vote that after passing the first creditors' review next month, completing the planned bank recapitalization, and resolving any outstanding debt issues, his government would, quote, proceed at a measured pace to change Greece, closed quote. Greece is scheduled to implement its third EU and IMF bailout program, as agreed with its European creditors in August. Athens will receive 86 billion euros, or $97 billion, in exchange for enacting austerity reforms as part of the deal. Tsipras said he was confident the terms would be met, noting the first bailout review should be completely finished sometime in November. Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe reshuffled his cabinet Wednesday with the announced purpose of reviving the world's third biggest economy. Nine ministers were replaced. New government minister Katsunobu Kato will steer programs aimed at strengthening the economy. The new focus on economic issues comes after Abe pushed through unpopular security legislation last month, allowing Japan's government expanded war powers. As we reported earlier in the week, trade ministers negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, or TPP, announced that they'd reached a deal on the Pacific Trade Pact that's intended to cut trade barriers and establish common standards for 12 nations. It's the largest trade agreement in 20 years and has been a long-term goal of the Obama administration. Although the U.S.-led deal includes Japan and a number of emerging economies in Asia and along the Pacific coast of Latin America, China is notably absent from the group. Professor Liu Bao-cheng of the School of International Business and Economics in Beijing appearing on the program Dialogue on China's CCTV, offered these observations.
Well, I think Shinzo Abe is having a deliberate intention to please the United States, and therefore, during the trilateral negotiation between China, South Korea, and Japan, and he delayed the process simply just to show that, well, he is the first one to jump on the wagon organized by the United States. But the fact that the United States is sitting in the driver's seat really created an uncomfortable situation for China in terms of the geopolitical consideration. And on the other hand, they are pushing forward for a common market, which is China is not really fully ready. And in the meantime, the whole operation during the TPP negotiation has been kept under really ill transparency, I should say. So therefore, China is somewhat staying in the dark.
For more on this, we spoke with Professor Richard Wolff, professor of economics and visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs at the New School University in New York, via Skype from New York, Thursday. Dr. Wolff, welcome back. So it appears that the TPP will be going forward. Your thoughts?
Well, I wouldn't count my proverbial chickens too soon. within minutes of the announcement of the quote-unquote final agreement, major players around the world, the pharmaceutical industry in the United States, the tobacco industry in the United States, the Ford Motor Company in the United States, and analogs elsewhere had announced their implacable opposition. And if you have folks like that in opposition that's implacable, given the resources they can bring to this, it would be naive to imagine that there's anything final about this final agreement. So everything we say has to be kept in the context of that reality. The second thing is many of the details are not known because they haven't been released publicly. That's a process that will go on in a haphazard and probably contested way. The reason that the industries I just listed oppose it is because they have their own representatives sitting in on one or another of these meetings. Their lobbyists are all over this process. And so they know what we in the public don't know, and that has been kept systematically secret, something that should also not be forgotten about all of this. So we don't know exactly what the final agreement is. Other players in the game do know. They're all lining up for and against. So it is highly questionable what exactly the final reality will be. That's the first thing. The second thing is there are political realignments that are now going to play a role that we did not foresee as little as 6 months ago. There are oppositions to globalization around the world that see this as part of the globalization they don't want. And they're going to line up politically in country after country, not just in the dozen that are party to this agreement, but in many countries that are not, in opposition to one or another of the entire deal. And here in the United States, you can see that as well. The absolutely astonishing success of the Bernie Sanders insurgency within the Democratic Party has now forced Hillary Clinton to come out against the TPP that she earlier supported. It's an open question whether this will help her, but it means another layer of political opposition. She's going to have to play this out. Sanders is an implacable opponent of the TPP, and not just on this or that detail, but on the whole procedure, the process, the secrecy, all the rest of it. And he has now basically forced Clinton to at least appear to be on the negative side. And as she is required to commit more She will mobilize an opposition inside the Democratic Party, which makes the Obama administration's job twice as difficult. With the Democrats, it will have to win over if there's any chance of passage, given the corporate opposition. So one big question that everybody should know is that this is light years from being over. And the word final used in describing anything is simply a ploy of those who want to get it done. And they think it'll help them by calling it final, but it is nothing of the sort.
Now, meanwhile, you mentioned the fact that there is political opposition to this outside of the dozen or so countries that are involved directly. And, for example, there is an analog deal, the TTIP, in Europe that is also a focal point of much opposition. And at a kind of critical time with the rise of just the whole anti-neoliberal political constituency in Europe, how do you see this playing into that?
Same thing. I think you're absolutely right. It's part of a global reaction. I mean, the neoliberalism that was the ideological veneer, if you like, of the boom, capitalist boom from roughly 1975, 1980 until the crash in 2008, has not been able to survive that crash. That is, it's still there, it's still a powerful force, but it has been basically, and in my own opinion, fatally compromised by the economic downturn since 2008. And so the neoliberal consensus is harder and harder to sustain. The majority of Europeans, like the majority of Americans, have turned against it. That hasn't shown up in policy so much yet, because the distance between European and American governments on the one hand and popular and public opinion on the other has probably never been greater in many of these countries' histories, our own included, so that it's like the old cartoon I remember as a child. You have Daffy Duck, you know, running along the countryside and then running straight beyond where the cliff falls off, but he's still up in the air until he looks down and realizes there isn't any ground underneath him, and then, of course, he collapses down. We're a little bit like that. We have governments everywhere that are running like Daffy Duck or Roadrunner or whoever the character in the cartoon was, and it's only a question until they're forced to look down when this whole house of fakery collapses in on itself. And the TPP and its European counterpart are perfect examples of good candidates for being that moment when everybody kind of suddenly, even though it shouldn't have been sudden, suddenly realizes that the mass public support, which in the end is the only thing that guarantees these things will mean anything, just isn't there. And so they've spent a great deal of time, a little bit like Sisyphus, in a task that they can't pull off and simply can't face the reality of that situation. And we haven't even opened up the question that part of this TPP is an effort, which I also believe to be hopeless, an effort to somehow limit, constrain, control the rise of China. And much of American policy in Asia has now become a kind of knee-jerk effort to do that. But under circumstances unlike anything the United States has tried before, and with no sign that that's understood. It's sort of sad to watch, almost like children in a game in which they don't understand that the rules prevent them from doing what they keep trying to do, and they don't learn as they fail to try it in a different way. Let me explain. The problem is, in the history of countries fighting with one another, you typically had one country with its politicians more or less lined up with its major economic interests. So here in the United States, the struggle against the Germans and the Japanese in World War II, or their enemies in World War I, or any other war you pick, you pretty much had a reasonably close alignment between the United States government on the one hand and the major corporations that run our economy on the other, so that they could work together. You don't have that now. The major corporations in the United States, many of them have enormous interests inside China, completely subject to the pleasure of the Chinese government. True, the Chinese government doesn't want to offend the corporations because they need them. On the other hand, the corporations are in a relationship with the quote-unquote enemy of America in this situation that makes them mutually dependent and mutually supportive. So that when the United States government seeks to move against China, it discovers it has opposition inside the United States from American corporations who function as unofficial, implicit allies of the Chinese, because for their own private profit-maximizing reasons, they have to do that. And that's a whole new ballgame. Excluding the Chinese in certain ways is going to hurt the General Electric or the General Motors or the you name it that's busy inside China and has a better future for itself there than it does anywhere else in the world, and is going to fight like the Dickens not to lose its competitive advantage by having its interests in China compromised by the American government, which they then begin to see as a pain in the rear end, and that makes the enemies of American foreign policy on the government level a whole new ballgame of internal opposition. And I think that this is going to play itself out in ways that, again, are going to take a good while to get into the press because of the need to deny, for other reasons, just how... how can I put this politely? Just how far corporate abandonment of the United States by American, or putatively American corporations, how far that has gone in the last 40 years.
You know, I'm wondering if we're seeing a little taste of that today, even in Japan, where the Abe government has just essentially changed the rules with respect to the constitutional prohibition against war, which is highly unpopular. In order to prop itself up among the population, it essentially, Abe conducted a reorganization of the cabinet, declaring that there was an emphasis on trying to restart the Japanese economy. And Japan's economy, of course, one of the problems that it faces is this contradictory relationship to China, with the United States almost mediating that, and Japan not being able to fully exploit the Japanese market. I'm sorry, the Chinese market. I'm wondering if some of that is at play right now in Tokyo.
Absolutely. The how do I put this? The Japanese economy ought to be, and again, if it weren't for the, I'm searching only to be polite, for the limits of American mainstream media, if it weren't for those limits, it would be easier to talk about the absolutely stunning object lesson that Japan presents. Japan was the leading Asian economy, the second economy after the United States, catching up to the United States up until basically 1989, 1990, when the Japanese economy collapsed in on itself. And it has never recovered. Let me say that again. 25 years, a generation has passed of depressed Japan's economy. Every government, and there have been lots of them, has tried one way or another with monetary policy, with fiscal policy, to get Japan out of this depression and back on the growth path it once enjoyed. every single effort by every single government today has failed. And that is a very scary proposition. It ought to be scary just with what I've said. But if you add to that that the United States economy imploded in on itself in 2008 and has had a very hard time getting out of that situation and still hasn't done it, and the latest economic data suggests not that we're going up, but that we're actually going back down again, you'd think that the Japanese model of where we might be would be scaring the dickens out of people and be a focus. Again, the power of denial is spectacular. And I think what you see in Japan now is an attempt to see whether a massive program of rearmament, redeployment of their military, perhaps with all kinds of reliable or unreliable promises of assistance from the United States for doing this, because it gives the United States another pawn in the chess game with China to mobilize the Chinese. Because don't forget, and this is Americans don't get this too well, the history of China and Japan over the last century is full of bitternesses that people remember. The Japanese invaded China back in 1930-31. They did unspeakable, horrible things to the Chinese in a whole raft of major Chinese cities. That's part of the history of modern China. There are people still alive who experienced that. It's real to them. The distance between Japan and China in terms of bitternesses, contested regions of that part of the world, economic contest. The Japanese have been going nowhere. The Chinese have basically caught up and surpassed them on many economic indices. This is opening up a terribly dangerous, fraught kind of contestation. The United States would never have done that if it weren't itself desperate about its situation in Asia, and therefore no longer were weighing the risks of what they are doing. It's not a sign of strength. It's a sign of exactly the opposite, which, by the way, the Chinese have clearly stated they can see exactly what's going on, but that they're going to have to now defend themselves. They're going to be undercutting the TPP every which way and leaning on the American and other corporations to do the same. And they have real leverage, because if an American corporation doesn't turn against TPP and thereby does anger the Chinese government, the Chinese have ways to make that company pay dearly for having done that, giving its business over to its own competitors. None of this is being faced in the American media. We're all supposed to think that this is some sort of brilliant coup on the departing Mr. Obama. I mean, it's kind of childish. And what it does, though, is obscure all of the realities so that they can be fought out by the companies and the politicians that are secretly working all this out.
You know, I'm going to ask you to put on your Marxist scholar's hat for a minute to discuss this particular thing. And I always roll around in my head, let's see, Marxist professor of economics or professor of Marxist economics. In this particular case, looking at the United States, first of all, culturally, in many ways, like in the media, for example, we still haven't really recovered from the purges of the McCarthy era, the removal of the left, essentially, from so many public institutions, including the media and all of that. In China, they had Cultural Revolution had a massive impact on the culture, and certainly just about everyone there has some basic understanding of the Marxist dynamics of history. Part of that narrative, part of that concept, is essentially that the bourgeoisie, after helping to lead the construction of an industrial base, becomes a parasite upon it and is pushed away because it's no longer needed. I'm wondering if Chinese people in leadership positions, but even among the general population, look at these American corporations in the same way within China, having constructed the factories, having trained the employees and the management, and, you know, having these things operating. If there's a point in time when they're going to be seen as superfluous, and their ability to influence events within China becomes almost irrelevant.
Yeah, I think the way I would put it is that the ability of a corporation, say, in a Western country, the United States, Western Europe, Japan, I mean, not a Western country, but a conventional, traditional capitalist country, the ability of the corporations to manipulate public opinion, to control, usually by ownership, the mass media, and therefore to shape what they say, has been, I'm going to make it simple, but it has been sufficient to prevent that Marxist perspective you just summarized from gaining very much traction. That is, it has prevented the notion of corporate capitalism being a phase of development, something that arises at a certain time, that grows and develops, but then, like every organic entity, dies off. It has prevented that last part of the story from being made part of popular consciousness. This is going to play out differently in China, I would guess. We'll see. The reason it will play out likely differently in China is because of the complicated role there of nationalism on the one hand, and Marxist and socialist ideology on the other. Neither of those played the same role in Western Europe, North America, Japan. What do I mean? Well, the Chinese have always, from the beginning under Mao, right through to the present, viewed the opening to corporations from the West as a temporary phenomenon to be kept subordinate to the national interests of China, that it will never again be under the thumb of Western colonial powers the way it was in much of the 19th century and pretty much the first half of the 20th century. This is a new experience. They do not want to have that again. They therefore looked at these foreign corporations as people they would invite in order to get their expertise, their connections, their technologies, but then thank you very much, now go away, or accept a very subordinate role. When you add to that nationalist notion of who's in charge, the Marxist or socialist notion that these capitalist corporations are evil, are institutions that are anti a worker, that are anti-democracy, and so on, you have a powerful combination of strong ideology, even stronger nationalism, that means that the corporations are going to have a much harder time controlling the government, the mass popular consensus in that society than they're used to in the West. And I don't think most of these corporations have the first idea of this problem or how to manage it. They're probably counting on their Chinese counterparts, that is, the private owners of the increasingly important private enterprises that are part of the Chinese economy, to be their natural allies and to therefore enable them to prevail as partners. That may happen. Who knows? I mean, no one can predict the future. But my guess is that that's not strong enough to counter all of the other pressures, and that the one thing we can be sure of is controlling China in the interests of modern corporate capitalism is a much more difficult process and prospect than it has proven to be in the West.
Okay. Dr. Wolf, thank you very much for your time. A pleasure as always.
Okay, Don, talk to you in the future.
Yep. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.